from KQED.
Welcome to the Forum Program. I'm Michael Krasny. And in Dave Eggers' latest book, The Captain and the Glory, an entertainment, an inexperienced and dishonest man becomes the captain of a storied ship. Hired to shake things up, the captain discards all of the ship's books and terrorizes its once-welcome refugees. And Dave Eggers is here to talk about his new book, An Allegory of the Trump Era, and the role of satire in contemporary politics. Dave Eggers, I should say, is the author of many books, including A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, The Monk of Mocha, and What is the What? He also founded McSweeney's, an independent publishing company, and co-founded the Literacy Project, A26 Valencia, and A26 Valencia, and the human rights nonprofit Voice of Witness. Welcome back to Forum, Dave Eggers.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Good to see you. It almost sounds in many people's minds perhaps like a quip to say you write a satire about the Trump administration, because it's always almost satirizing itself. But this is called an entertainment in respect of Graham Greene, I realize, but also it is an allegory.
Yeah. I mean, I think like everybody, every writer has tried to think about how to approach this time. And I've been approaching it as a reporter since the beginning, mostly by going to Trump rallies and also talking to asylum seekers and other recent immigrants who have been affected by his policies. So those two angles were sort of my work as a reporter. And all along, that kind of work was rewarding in that I could really get deep into both the mindset of a Trump supporter at a rally and what drives their support of this guy, but also to really try to illuminate just how horrific the conditions are for recent arrivals. But all of that didn't quite get at this surreality and the absurdity of the era. So it was almost too sane, that reporting. It almost like it lessened the absurdity of the time. And so while I was doing that on the side, I was writing and outlining this satire that I thought could sort of better reflect the more heightened, the more ludicrous, the more beyond belief sort of aspects of the era.
Well, I read your reporting, very good, diligent reporting, I might add. And one of the things that you came across with was empathy for trying to understand Trump supporters, but nevertheless seeing them as, in fact, you said the craziest and most lunatic sounding one that you talked to was hearing Trump himself speaking to this revival group crowd or whatever it was. And yet in the satire, they're all wearing chicken suits. I mean,
yeah,
taking it to that absurd that you just mentioned.
Yeah. I went to a rally 2 weeks ago in Hershey, Pennsylvania, on the day that the articles of impeachment were handed down. And I thought I had to be there to see what everybody's reaction would be and what Trump's reaction would be. And at every rally I go to, everybody I interview, I like them a lot. You know, I just have a
regular people,
and every single person I have ever talked to knows the ludicrous aspects and rolls their eyes at the tweets and can't stand the hypocrisy, I guess, and the contradictions and the lying. There's a lot. They have very nuanced opinions, but there's always something that has motivated their support. And in this case, more than anything, I talked to evangelicals, I talked to people from every walk of life. And this time, everybody was saying, or most of the people I spoke to could point to concrete evidence that they had gotten from their accountants, from their bookkeepers, that they had more in their pocket now than they did a few years ago. And they attribute this to Trump's policies. And so if you talk to – there was, you know, 13,000 people at this rally in Hershey, Pennsylvania, which is a state that the Democrats have to win in 2020. And when you talk about historically low unemployment in Pennsylvania, stock market at an all-time high, and then people that come to this rally saying, well, I have $2,800 more in my pocket than I did a few years ago, or, you know, the equivalent of last year that's where the Democrats really have to think hard about how can they offer a better economic prospect than Trump, because I think so many of these voters are malleable. The last guy I talked to, he was in a full Santa outfit, Trump pins everywhere and a Santa hat that said, "Make America Great Again." And I talked to him for 15 minutes, And I thought he was the most out there, dyed-in-the-wool Trump supporter you could ever imagine. And then at the 16th minute of our talk, he said that he had voted for Obama in 2012, and had volunteered for him in 2008. So it just shows that when we think of this unmovable 40-42% of Trump supporters, it's not a concrete thing. There's movability, there's porosity, there's malleability. And I think people have much more nuanced opinions than we give them credit for.
Well, you're suggesting the old Carville notion, it's the economy stupid for so many of these people. You might have 401ks doing okay, but there's a lot of poverty and a lot of people who are supposed to be advanced who have not advanced, and there certainly is disaffection on that score. But the thing that I keep coming back to in my own mind is how people seem to rallying behind him because they're fearful of immigrants.
Yeah.
And your book takes that up. I mean, the cruelty throwing refugees off the ship when they have traditionally come on the ship and been allowed to come on the ship is a perfect metaphor.
Yeah, I wanted – so, you know, I moved – instead of setting a satire in D.C., which would sort of be impossible to kind of try to replicate the madness that we see on a daily basis in the actual place where it exists, I moved all the setting, moved all the characters to a cruise ship, which is sort of inherently comedic, you know.
It's a ship of state.
Yeah, it's a ship of state. There's fewer people. There's a few thousand people. And so the U.S. exists as this country/ship called the Glory. And it's always been a beacon of hope on the seas for small vessels that will approach full of, you know, the most vulnerable and the most oppressed people. They come to this ship and they feel welcomed, they're brought aboard, and they're given a life and an opportunity and a role to play. And when this new captain is elected to lead a ship, though he's never steered a ship and has no respect
for
ships.
Knows nothing about navigation.
Yeah, knows nothing about navigation, doesn't even like boats, he says.
And has spent the war, and there was a war, in the bowels of the ship reading pornography. I just want to get that in there because it's a significant way of satirizing, along with the women who have to appear in bathing suits.
Yeah. Well, he points to that being in the bowels of the ship reading pornography as posing significant risk to himself because all that time he could have gotten caught.
Right.
You know, so there he had a certain kind of bravery for hiding. And, you know, ultimately – The book is, you know, I try to heighten the situation and put it in, you know, starker relief than we see it. But at the end of the day, there is the policies produce misery and cruelty that's institutionalized on a level that I don't think I've seen in my lifetime in terms of our immigration policies. And so instead of well, we end up with humans in cages in the book too, but you know, those that they deem unworthy of being on the Glory or in some way they don't value anymore are thrown overboard and drowned, and all of the vulnerable ships that come from every part of the sea for refuge, they're knocked out of the water, they're sunk before they can get close, and so it creates this sort of high tolerance for a passive kind of cruelty that we've seen these last 3 years. And what's so interesting, especially you mentioned the support Trump has among evangelicals in particular, is so high and it's so immovable. And I interviewed some at this last rally.
Well, there was an editorial recently that showed it a bit of a fissure, you know about that, in Christianity Today, where he was criticized under the articles of impeachment, essentially. Yeah.
But, you know, that what's driving so much of that, there was a recent article that had the statistics about their opinions on immigration. They are the most conservative about immigration, the evangelical voters. And that's what's so strange, because if you consider yourself born again and you have a personal relationship with Jesus, this is like a human that is, you know, venerated for his tolerance, for his acceptance, for his spirit of welcome and compassion for all. And I think that so many evangelicals really live this, and the people that I've talked to do. But there's this incredible disconnect where when it comes to immigrants, all of that compassion or so much of it and empathy just completely falls away, and they take an incredibly hard and punitive line. And that, I can understand my fellow humans to a certain extent. And then there's always like this drop-off point where I lose track of
the disconnect. The
reasoning. Yeah. And so, you know, I talked to a group of evangelical voters after this rally, and they were so warm and so kind, and we had a really good talk, and they, you know, they're full of love, you know, these folks that I was talking to. But at the same time, when it comes to the immigration policies, I think like so many of our policies here in the U.S., they are driven by they can go from a warm-hearted, warm-bloodedness to an incredibly cold and punitive sort of state of mind. And I think that that's
it's what they call America paranoia, too. I think it goes back to Hofstadter and all of that. But there's also a sense of not only fear where immigrants are concerned, but abortion. I mean, as far as the evangelicals are concerned, there's a new article in Politico which talks about how abortion was really not a big issue for evangelicals up until fairly recently. The big issue, the argument goes, was race and trying to essentially keep things separate. And that has to do with immigration as well. It certainly ties in. But there's also, I mean, in addition to the cruelty, you bring about just a recognition of this president's vanity and pettiness. And I mean, even to the extent where the former captain has draws pictures on him, you know, that a kid would do, you know, scrawling the pictures, making his teeth big and putting horns on him and all of that sort of thing. I mean, you really do bring out just the different sides of the president. And yet those in favor of the president, those in support of the president say, what about his virtues? What about his, you know, he says it like it is and he talks like it, you know, and he is able to put people in their place and he's able to really essentially speak to truth.
You know, when Giuliani has gotten himself in so much trouble, there's a perfect parallel there that we've seen, which is Trump is very loyal to Giuliani because he feels like he's the one guy that fights for him. And he's messy and he always misspeaks and he creates more trouble than he's worth half the time. But he's there fighting and he's willing to get on TV and fight for Trump. Trump voters very often see Trump as that guy, the one guy that's willing to get out there, stand up to anybody, tell it like it is.
For them.
For them.
Yeah.
And so they don't care, just as Trump doesn't care so much or until recently didn't care so much about just how messy Giuliani was as an advocate. Trump voters very often are saying, for once somebody's out there punching, swinging,
counterpunching.
And so I can get that. And then, you know, I was on the floor of this last rally. So I've been to many rallies, but I've never been so close. So I was about 30 feet away this time. And 11,000 people in the audience, a couple thousand in the parking lot. And he puts on a show. So much of the appeal is not necessarily always, I mean, the economic policies are important to a lot of people, but he is
it's an like, entertainer.
It's like watching Andrew Dice Clay. I always compare comic timing, his accent, everything is Andrew Dice Clay.
They're from a similar part of Queens, too, I think.
Yeah. So it's the guy on the street corner of Queens just sort of spouting off anything that comes
except
to his
Dice,
mind.
To give him his credit, had some blue collar. Trump did. Trump had a silver gold spoon in his mouth from the beginning, and people don't seem to bring that into the calculus.
Yeah.
We're talking, by the way, with Dave Eggers, and we're talking about his most recent book, The Captain and the Glory in Entertainment. He's the founder of McSweeney and A26 Valencia. If you'd like to join us in conversation here, we invite you to do that. You can become part of the program, and our toll-free number is available for that. It's 866-733-6786 if you'd like to join us in conversation, or if you have a question or comment about what we're talking about here, which is for the most part Trump. Latest book, The Captain and the Glory in Entertainment, is essentially about an inexperienced and dishonest man becoming the captain of a storied ship. Guess what that may reflect. You can also, of course, get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. And in fact, talk about someone who is not at all equipped to be the captain of the ship and all of that. I'm looking early on in your book where you say, but over the years, this notion had come to mean that any imbecile might decide on a certain Monday to become a captain, and by Tuesday, with no qualifications whatsoever, that imbecile could take charge of a 300,000-ton vessel and the thousands of lives contained within. To underline the point, one thoughtful man stepped forward, a pedagogical index finger in the air. Quote, if we truly believe that anyone can grow up to be a captain, he said, we should prove it by electing the least qualified, least respected person on the ship, a man who has never done anything for anyone but himself, a man who has palpable disdain for all previous captains and no respect at all for the builders of the ship, its history, or anything it stands for. And it does sort of tie in a strange way with this idea of anybody can become president.
Yeah. I think we have to rethink this maxim and sort of what it's supposed to mean. And I think as an electorate, we don't necessarily take our vote as seriously as we need to be. I mean, this is a man. I think that we can all agree that no matter what kind of company you run or work for, you would not hire him to work under you or with you.
Dave, right? Forgive me. This is a man who is the head of this republic, the most powerful man in the world, and who was talking about airports during the Revolutionary War,
yeah,
or said statements about hurricanes in Alabama or about wind power that just make no sense under anybody's rubric.
And so you would not, you know, I always think that we need to think about our elected leaders and choose them the way we would choose an accountant. You want somebody sober, steady, rational, reliable, you
temperament,
know, honest, and you would never, if you sussed out any whiff of dishonesty, you would not hire this person to handle your money, right? And now imagine that multiplied by 320 million we have chosen, and with all due respect to the Trump voters, they have chosen somebody who they would not hire to handle their personal taxes and to file their return. And I think that we put too much weight on celebrity, on charisma, on notoriety, on who is the loudest mouth on the street corner.
Some of these things, like he's a businessman. He's a businessman who's had, you know, quite a few setbacks, to put it mildly, in businesses. Trump University comes immediately to mind. But also you hear the argument that not only is he a businessman, but he's someone who thinks like the lay populace because of this populist movement that's behind him. And does he, or does he think mainly like a rich man that he's been his whole life?
Yeah, I think there is a lot of respect out there. When I've talked to people, they do have respect for what he has done as a businessman because of The Apprentice in particular. That seemed to them to mean that he is a good businessman because he was put on TV as a businessman, that he played one on TV. But
also a good negotiator, we hear. And yet there's a figure in your book called the Pale One, who is obviously based on Putin. And there's, you know, a clear kind of Nancy Pelosi press said it best. Everything seems to lead to Putin. There's this admiration. We don't even know how far it goes or how deep or why, but there it is.
Yeah, in the book, there's another pirate on the seas called the Pale One, for whom the captain has an undying admiration. And ultimately, he allows the Pale One to tie up his own ship, and they tie up the ships together, and the Pale One's minions get on the ship and plunder it for everything it's worth. And then there's Bloodbeard, who is a little bit of an MBS character, and then the Man So Soft, who is might reside in a country like North Korea, where they end up stripping the ship of the glory completely clean. And I think that...
And that corpse filled with guacamole. I mean, change of Conrad, you know, the horror.
Well, I wanted to take it to its logical extreme, where ultimately Trump is not, he does not have the inner, I guess, he's not the level of pirate that Putin is, but he aspires to be, but ultimately he's proven a paper tiger when he's among these true, evildoers of the ocean. And so the book, although that it has corollaries with what we've seen in Trump's years, I wanted to take it
corollaries. You've got names like Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort.
Michael Cohen.
I want to, in fact, get to hope in this book, as there is. But let me get to some calls first, and let me bring first Scott on the air. Scott, you're on.
Good morning.
Morning.
I consider myself fortunate because I have about equal Republicans in my family and equal Democrats, and I like to talk to both of them. They respectively think each other, they're idiots, or there must have been something wrong at birth. But many of my Republican relatives say they're not the type to go to rallies. I don't know what the type of person to go to rallies is, but they say that they're more concerned about the left and their rate of progress and demand for, I don't want to say progress, demands, I guess. And so they're choosing the lesser of two devils. And one of their litmus test questions is, what do you consider to be a female? What is a woman? So I guess they feel out the other person by saying, in your mind, what is a woman? You could even say, what is a man? But Dave, what to your mind, what is a woman? If you don't mind defining.
Wait a minute, are your relatives talking about shades of bathrooms in North Carolina and that kind of thing?
What do you consider to be a female? What is a woman?
Well, I'm asking Dave a question for the perennial philosophical, I think, but it does get into your satire somewhat. I mean, women are essentially objectified. They have a whole group called the Upskirts, you know.
Well, in the book, the captain, his they call themselves the Upskirt Coterie, and it's a bunch of con men and ne'er-do-wells who hang out near the women's bathroom trying to get photos of women walking up the stairs. And so, and they all have sort of, you know, dubious pasts, and they
grifters,
and but they all see the election of their fellow grifter as like the most ludicrous thing they've ever heard of, and they cannot believe that it's really happening. And I think you saw that among Trump's allies and friends, like during the primary, they could not believe that this was happening. So many of them dropped off along the way when he did this or that offensive thing, including the Access Hollywood tape. But eventually, those that stuck with him, like the Jeff Sessions of the world, were just gleeful and flabbergasted. And I wanted to reflect that. And so the captain has a group of supporters called the Most Foul, because sort of a young woman who had, she said, don't, you know, let's not vote for the most foul among us. And so they sort of adopt that gleefully with a sort of a sense of humor, and they dress up as chickens and other birds with full feathers and everything to attend these rallies and celebrations. And
the caller's question is pointed, though. I mean, you know, in some respects, there are people fearful of fluid gender identity and of sexuality changing the way it's been changing.
Right. Yeah, I think obviously the term conservative, you know, traditionally Republicans were known as conservatives, you know, where they wanted a slower rate of change. And they weren't necessarily comfortable.
We also wanted no deficits. And look where we are.
No deficits. I mean, obviously, Trump in no way is a conservative. You know, there are no conservative principles reflected in any of his
platforms. He used to be pro-choice when he was in New York. Yeah. I mean, let me get another caller on. Aaron, join us. You're on. Morning.
Hi. David, I appreciate the nuance and the education that you granted the Trump voters that you met at the rallies, but I'm wondering why you don't extend that same sense of nuance and education to their opinions on immigration. I live in California, and I have friends and colleagues that are immigrants, illegal and legal. They're all lovely people.
Yeah.
Yet I also acknowledge that immigration has consequences, including the burden that it places on our public system, such as been pointed out in the earlier comp interview. And I just wonder, why am I painted as a xenophobe as opposed to just acknowledging that immigration has consequences? And as a voter, I have a right to say who we accept and don't accept into our country.
Well, well said. I think that there is nuance, and there should be rational policies. There should be I think clearly articulated.
I have to think of immigration in terms of sustainability, don't we?
Well, sustainability, but also we do have to. I think we have to start from a place like, as a country, are we known as a welcoming, compassionate place for the most vulnerable of the world?
And it's certainly embedded in our history.
It's embedded in our history. And if we acknowledge that, what Emma Lazarus wrote on the Statue of Liberty, you know, and that we have sort of lived for, well, centuries now, this has been questioned and reversed, starting with Stephen Miller clearly saying that the Statue of Liberty did not stand for this, and Lazarus's poem was later, and all of these things were sort of revisionist ideas of the United States. We do have to come to an agreement, like, are we a compassionate place of welcome because we, our entire identity is wrapped up in the notion of immigration and being a home for the oppressed, for the most vulnerable of the world. And unless you are Native American, you are an immigrant. We have to start there. And so we do have to think about extending our compassionate, our compassion forward. I don't mean that we have, obviously there needs to be order. There needs to be policies that make sure that it's done rationally. But I do think that we need immigration to exist as a country, to thrive. We do need and always benefit from new arrivals because they are the most entrepreneurial. They are the greatest dreamers of the American dream. And if we want to be a vital, exciting, innovative country, we do need new arrivals, and we always will.
Well, we're also up against alternate facts, to use Kellyanne Conway's idea, like we said, interpreting Emma Lazarus in a way that had maybe nothing to do with Emma Lazarus. We've got seconds left. I would be remiss if I didn't bring in Anna into this conversation, because in a sense, you're saying younger generation is vested with some hope.
Well, ultimately, there's this young girl who's 12 who is the one person throughout the book that is seeing things clearly. And I think that in the last few years especially, we have been looking to younger people for moral clarity, whether it's Greta Thunberg or we have a group called the International Congress of Youth Voices, where it's supposed to – we're trying to get teen voices into the media, into the mainstream media.
You include the squad?
What?
Do you include the squad?
Who's the squad?
Octavio Cortez.
Oh, that squad. Well, sure. They're much younger than I think, you know, so many members of
Congress. Ocasio Cortez, excuse me. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that, but I think teen voices in particular, they look at us on climate change, on so many issues, and they just cannot believe the inaction and the lack of clarity and the lack of moral sort of gumption. And I think that sometimes we can find that inspiration when we ask them their opinions and we follow their lead.
Dave, always good to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your new book, The Captain and the Glory by Dave Eggers. It is out and it is available. And we will be available for another hour of Forum. We're going to talk in the hour ahead about black technology. Professor McElwain, Charlton McElwain, will be joining us. He has a book called Black Software. And we'll also be talking about this Moms for Housing activist seeking the right of possession in a housing case. So stay tuned for those there in the next hour. Thank you for being with us for this hour. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.